ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் shaivam.org, தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். த டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் கர்மா மேனேஜ்மெண்ட் ஃபோர் அண்ட் ரிவீல்டு ஸ்கிரிப்சர்ஸ் அண்ட் ஆரிஜின் ஆஃப் கர்மா மேனேஜ்மெண்ட், பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. தேங்க்யூ. ஓம் நம சிவாய.
Third vrata is Dasama Bhagavrata, which of course relates to our finances, but the point Gurudeva makes is it's also a way of controlling desire. So Chakahara helps us control the instinctive mind, Parampara Vrata helps us control the intellectual mind, and Dasama Bhagavrata helps us harness desire. And why is that? Well, that's because lots of desires are fulfilled by spending money, right? We're desiring things, desiring physical objects, and to get them we have to spend money. So the two go together. So the measure of that is, you know, when you get a paycheck, what happens? What's the first thing that happens? What do when we get a paycheck? Do we rush to the store and buy this thing we've been dying to get for a couple of weeks that we can't live without? Or do we do something else? But modern advertising, being what it is and desire being what it is, sometimes that's what people do. When they just rush to the store with their paycheck and buy some things that they really think they can't live without, and then a few months later, they don't use them anymore. Then they buy something new and use that for a few months, and so forth. Frivolous desire. So therefore, in fulfilling the Dasama Bhagavrata, the key is, what do we do first? Because that sets the tone for how we're handling the money. What do we do first with this money? So the idea is, well, we give a portion of it to God. We spiritualize the whole process. We think about God, and we don't think about fulfilling some frivolous desire with it as our first action. We think about, well, let's give a portion of this back to God, because without God's blessings, it wouldn't have come in the first place. So we give a portion of it back, and of course that's 10% and it's part of the Vrata. And for those who are just starting this practice, it's good to do it in some kind of ceremony. In other words, it's a new habit that we want to establish. And until the habit gets strong, it's easier to fulfill it all the time by sticking it in a ceremony. So the ceremony we suggest is take your paycheck into the shrine room, do a little Ganesha Arati, seeking Ganesha's blessings, then write your tithing check. Give the portion to God as the first expense, as part of a ceremony. And, you know, after you've done that for a few years, then it's automatic. You would never think of doing anything with your income until you'd written your tithing check. It would be a strongly ingrained habit. So that's what we suggest to those who are just developing the practice and making it a habit in their life. So a further step in fulfilling the Dasama Bhagavrata is to spend the whole amount of your money in a wise way, not just give 10% to God and then waste the rest without any particular plan. And that's not the goal. The goal is to spend it in a wise way, and of course, Gurudeva suggests having a budget, a household budget, and it's been developed according to your income and future plans, and to spend the money wisely to benefit all the members of the family in appropriate ways, and to set aside money for long-term goals such as children's education and your own personal retirement should be part of the budget, and should be ideally saving for those on a monthly basis. So that's the goal of the Dasama Bhagavrata, is to bring a spiritual perspective into our financial life, and therefore harness desire and end up spending our money as wisely as possible for the benefit of all the members of the family. Gurudeva has some nice thoughts in conclusion, which I'll quote from him. They're so beautifully worded. Accepting the three vows is essential to anyone aspiring to be a shishya. The Devanic adepts, meaning the devas, take these vows very seriously, knowing that once a vow is taken at an auspicious moment in life, the karmas yet to come change slightly to the positive side so long as the vow is upheld. So that's a very interesting statement, which is worth thinking about. The karmas yet to come change slightly to the positive side. So that's how we change our karma. But we don't change it totally. It works out better than it would have otherwise. We change it slightly to the positive side by these kinds of disciplines. But when vows are neglected, the full force of the held back karma is not previously dissolved, mostly the bad ones, comes as a blow to individual family and friends. So we want to avoid that. Upholding these three vows, Trivrata, builds discipline and character. All of this mastery of the forces of mind, body, and emotion gives strength to face the future and perhaps, though there are no guarantees, to attain moksha, God realization, in this life. Well, this morning we may be setting our Guinness Book of Records here for the most people in Gaudiya Temple, at least in a long time. Usually when we have our ceremony to begin our week, Swami Bhua suggests it be louder. mic closer. Okay. I think Swami can't hear. Usually, is that any louder? Should be moved. Usually, when we give our talk after our ceremony, home ceremony that begins our week, we just have a few people here. But because the talk goes on the internet, I always visualize everyone who's listening on the internet around the world. And which creates a large audience. Also, I speak to them. But this morning, there's enough of you here. I don't need to do that. I just focus on everyone here. It's a very large group. So we're talking on karma, specifically karma management. That's nice volume. And as we talked about last night, we were comparing that to stress management, but I'll repeat that because a number of you present here this morning weren't there last night. So the teachings of Hinduism are often secularized, meaning they're drawn on in situations that makes them look like they have nothing to do with Hinduism. So the most popular example of that is still Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga is an integral part of Hinduism, but somehow it's been separated and secularized. So people are studying Hatha Yoga all throughout the Western world, and they feel it has no connection at all with Hinduism. How in the world was that achieved? Kind of amazing. And it's become much more popular. We have our own local barometer, which is Kapa'a Town. And today, you know, as you drive through Kapa'a, which you will be as part of your excursions, you look around and you'll see many, many signs advertising yoga classes, you know, big signs. There must be four or five different yoga studios in Kapa'a. Something that 30 years ago wasn't there, of course, when we first moved to the island. It's a new phenomenon. Kapa'a reflects it. And, of course, if you went in any of the yoga studios, there wouldn't be any connection to Hinduism, right? This is Hatha Yoga, nothing to do with Hinduism. But, of course, it does. It's a Hindu practice, but it's used quite often these days in stress management. So that's why we're talking about it, is it's an effective technique. It's become a technique for managing stress. A traditional Hindu practice, Hatha Yoga, is taken out of its Hindu context, secularized, and used to manage stress. And no one thinks twice about it these days. Well, of course they do. It doesn't have anything at all to do with Hinduism. So today we're taking a similar approach to karma management. And who knows, in the future, this might catch on. We could be starting a trend here today, so that institutes open up in Kapa'a 30 years from now, karma management institutes. Right. And, of course, it has nothing to do with Hinduism. No, karma management, no, nothing at all to do with Hinduism. It's a secular technique that comes from somewhere. So who knows? We might be starting that trend. So that's our idea, is that these principles can be applied, of course, by Hindus, but by anyone. Just like Hatha Yoga can benefit anyone, so can the principles of karma management benefit our lives. So about 2 years ago, we gave a talk at the local junior college on Hinduism. Professor Lydgate there teaches a world history class. And as part of it, every few years he has us drop in and explain Hinduism. So we asked about karma and explained about karma and asked for a definition of karma. And one of the students said, "What goes around comes around," which is an accurate definition of karma, of course, and in the person's own words, which shows they understand the principle. So karma has become very popular in Western movies and on television. You hear it mentioned all the time, and it's mentioned in a correct way, which is good. It's not misunderstood. It's clearly understood and becoming more and more a mainstream concept in the West. However, understanding karma correctly is not the end goal. To draw an analogy to nutrition, someone can study nutrition in school and get A's on all their tests. Too close? Okay. Be an expert in nutrition and still eat junk food 3 times a day. Possible, right? Why would that be? Because they haven't applied the knowledge that they've learned about nutrition to their daily life. It's just an intellectual subject that they can do well in. So karma can be the same, in that even though we understand the intricacies of karma, perhaps we're not applying it to our daily life, and therefore we're missing out on how it can really benefit us. Because if we don't apply it, it's just one more intellectual subject that we understand correctly. But its true benefit comes when we can apply it and change and improve our daily life. So we can look at karma, the study of karma, as a three-step process. The first step is alleviating any false concepts we have, correcting anything that we're not understanding correctly. And there are a number of false concepts about karma, and we'll look at one of them this morning. Once we get past correcting the false concepts, we want to learn the correct intellectual concepts. And again, we'll look at a few of those this morning. And then finally, we want to apply this knowledge to our life and change the way we interact with life into a more wise approach, taking this knowledge of karma, changing our life, and living more wisely. All of that can be summarized in one beautiful quote by Gurudeva. It is easy to study the law of karma and to appreciate it philosophically. But to realize it, to apply it to everything that happens to you, to understand the workings of it as the day goes by, requires an ability to which you must awaken. That means it's not self-evident. It's easy to miss applying it. So we want to think about that as we go through these 10 principles of effective karma management, which help us apply it in a systematic way. So, a misconception. After I give the misconception, I'll ask you to raise your hands and let me know how many of you have heard this misconception at least once before. So the misconception goes something like this. Nothing but bad things are happening to me. It's my karma. There's nothing I can do about it at all. Even if I try to change my karma and make things go better, I can't do it. It's hopeless. I give up. What can I do? How many of you have ever heard someone explain karma like that? Quite a few. Okay. So, this explanation, in fact, is responsible for this whole presentation. There was a young man in Maryland whose family is affiliated with the Murugan Temple in Maryland, and they were calling in for a satsang, a master course question and answer session over the phone. And so at one point this young man made that statement, and it got me fired up. I said, "Boy, this is about the third time in 2 months I've heard this. You know, it keeps coming in different ways. The third time in 2 months this statement has come." And then since then, there was a fourth time when we went back to Pennsylvania. Some young man stood up and said, "I don't like the law of karma," and said the same thing. So it's a common misconcept among younger people. People, say, under age 30, have this fatalistic idea about karma that it's bringing bad things to me, it's hopeless, I have a destiny that's unchangeable, what's the use, why even try? Hinduism just gives me no hope. So, of course, as we all know from Gurudeva's teachings, that's not a correct concept. It's a very flawed concept, but it's still a common one. So, why is it flawed? How is it flawed? It's flawed in two important ways. The first is, it says you can't change your karma, which isn't correct. Gurudeva gives us a number of techniques for changing our karma. And the name we use to describe that is mitigate, to lessen the effects of something. And we'll get into that at length, because that's one of the most important principles in effective karma management, is how can I mitigate my karma? How can I change it? How can I reduce the negative impacts of it? So we can. The second point, which should be self-evident, is the law of karma governs our future, right? It doesn't only govern our present. What we're doing now is creating our future. Don't we want to create a happy future, a problem-free future, a future in which we have plenty of everything we want, a future in which our spiritual life is going well? We're not just talking about this life, but next life, the life after. Don't we want to create that if we can? Well, we can create that by applying the law of karma to the future. But it's amazing, that's not commonly thought about. We tend to think just, oh, here I am in the present, this is all happening to me, it's my karma. But here I am in the present, creating my future. By how I live now, I'm going to create what I experience both in this life and in future lives. So that shows us the two ways in which this common misconcept is seriously flawed. We chose three concepts, correct concepts, to present this morning. Each time we give a talk, we'll choose a few concepts. We don't want to overwhelm everyone with all the terminology at once. So we're just throwing a few out every day and a few effective principles every day. Start with the obvious. What does the word karma mean? Just in case somebody doesn't know. Sometimes we don't start with the obvious and we keep going and we leave someone out. So we want to start with the obvious, which is karma means deed or action, right? That's what it means. The literal meaning of the word karma is deed or action. And one of the most common uses of the term, outside of just talking about karma as we were, is in karma yoga. How many of you have heard of karma yoga? Right. So karma yoga is the path of union through action, meaning we're doing good deeds, we're being selfless, we're helping others, and through that path, we create good karma and become closer to God. So it's a common use of the phrase karma, karma yoga. Second concept, karma as the law of karma. So that's one way in which it's commonly used. The law of karma, what goes around comes around, right? That's the popular understanding of the law of karma. The law of action and reaction, or the law of cause and effect, which is very simple. Whatever we send out to the world sends back to us. So Gurudeva would always, when visiting temples, be generous. He'd start building fund drives. Give the first $100. Well, he did it for a few reasons, one of which he's a very generous person, but he's creating funds coming back to us. You can't give anything away, really. Eventually, it comes back to you. So that's an example of the law of karma, being generous to others. Others are generous to you in the future. Likewise, if we're stingy to others, we don't share, we hoard, in the future, people will hoard from us. We will be without. So whatever we send out comes back to us in the future. Not only our actions create karma, but also our words and even our thoughts. So karma works at all levels. Even if we just think negative, terrible thoughts about certain people, that's hurting them. People are influenced by the thoughts about them. If we think positive thoughts about people, it makes them feel better. If we think negative, strong negative thoughts, not just a passing one, but strong negative thoughts about other people, it hurts them. So that'll come back to us as well. The third use of karma is one's individual karma. So the easiest way to think about that is every action has a reward or a punishment that goes with it. And it's like the justice system. So in the justice system, if you do something wrong, eventually you get punished. But it can take a long time because the justice system moves very slowly. The courts are backed up. It can take years before your wrong action is finally punished. But if you think the courts are slow, the law of karma is even slower. It can take lifetimes. And that's the part that we can't really see. So when we're born into this life, we bring with us all the rewards and punishments from our past actions that have not yet manifested, that have not yet expressed themselves. We bring them with us, both good karma and bad karma. So that's called an individual's karma. And sometimes when we jump back and forth between the law of karma and one's individual karma, and call both karma, it confuses people, which it should. should have another terminology, but we don't. We use karma to refer to both. So that's the idea, is to distinguish between karma when we're talking about the law of karma and karma when we're talking about an individual's karma that they bring into this life. Now we get our first principle. Those of you who read your lessons know what it is. It's forego retaliation. What in the world does retaliation have to do with karma? Doesn't sound like it's related at all. Karma usually comes to us through other people. It's rare that it just comes without another person being involved. You know, we don't usually walk along and have a tree branch fall on us and call it our karma. Usually it's another person who does something to us in one way or another. So there's other people involved in bringing our karma back to us, both our good karma and our bad karma. So it's human nature, when it's our bad karma, to get upset with them. I have an example here. Someone is very nasty to us, verbally abusive, and just treats us terribly. Of course, we're upset. So what do we do? Do we retaliate or do we forego retaliation? Well, it's a common problem in the world, is someone treats you unfairly or treats some member of your family unfairly and you feel you have to retaliate. The right thing to do is to retaliate. Well, then what will they do? Of course, they'll think the same way and they'll retaliate back. And then what will you do? You'll retaliate back, and how long will this go on? Could go on quite a while. So it creates an endless cycle of retaliation. So as long as we're retaliating, we can't manage our karma at all. We're really karmically making a mess. Because every time we retaliate, we're creating a new karma. And then it's coming back to us and so forth. We're stuck. Not only are we not making any progress, but we keep creating more negative karma. So lots of movies, I have a few actors here today, lots of movies portray the famous Western kind of concept. Something happens, there's a bank robbery, and a robber kills your brother. So you spend the rest of the movie chasing down the robber, right, and kill him. Old retaliation idea. Well, it's quite common in lots of movies, not only the classic Western, but other movies as well. And why is that? Because it's accepted behavior. This is what lots of people do, and they think it's right. It's called the eye for an eye approach. Someone harms me or harms my family, it's my duty to harm them back. But it's not the Hindu approach. Why isn't it the Hindu approach? Because no one harmed you. You harmed yourself. The action came through someone else. But they're just a channel for it. Why blame them? They're like the messenger, the famous story. Don't blame the messenger. Get upset when somebody delivers the message. I'm just the messenger. So they're just the messenger. They're returning your karma to you, because usually it'll have to come through another person. So we're missing the whole point, right? But at least, even if we get upset, it's important to forego retaliation. If we can't do that, none of the other principles will work, because they're more subtle than simply foregoing retaliation. The last point in that regard is to, you can sometimes count on others to handle the problem. It's like in the famous bank robbery idea, that someone commits a crime against a member of your family. Well, there is a justice system. There are police that take care of these things. There are courts that take care of these things. And if we allow them to take care of the problem, neither we nor they take on a karma. Because as long as they follow the laws, which they have been sworn to uphold, they don't create a karma, even if they have to shoot someone, if they can't avoid it. So in enforcing the law, a law officer doesn't create karma if they do it in a fair way. So Gurudeva again says it so beautifully, as long as we react, we must repeat it. That is the law. It's so short, I'll read it again. As long as we react, we must repeat it. That is the law. Second principle, which counts on the first principle being in place. So once we manage to harness our instinctive tendency to retaliate, we can move on to a more refined principle, which is to accept responsibility. So we were touching on that slightly before, which is the idea that whatever happens to you is your own creation. So usually that idea comes to us when everything's going great. We get the perfect job, we're earning lots of money, we're quite happy, everything's working out beautifully in our life, and who do we attribute the success to? Ourself, right? Well, of course, I created all this. It's going well because of me, just doing everything right. But when everything's going the opposite way, when everything is falling apart, when you're losing your job, when you don't have enough money, when there's domestic problems at home, who's responsible? Well, not you, of course. Must be somebody else's fault. Couldn't be my fault. So, of course, our thinking is flawed. Because in both cases, whatever we experience is within our karma. And our karma only comes from our own past actions. We can't experience anything that's not in our karma. It won't happen. There was an interesting story regarding September 11th in that regard. A member of a Patel family who has an office, used to have an office, in one of the World Trade buildings where a plane crashed into it, was on pilgrimage here. His family had talked him into coming on pilgrimage to Kauai's Hindu Monastery. So he wasn't there on the day he would normally be there. And consequently, the plane did not kill him. Very interesting. Then we heard another story from the news that there was a person in the Pentagon and the plane crashed into his office, but he was on the plane. So he was counted twice in the initial statistics. He was counted as being dead because it was his office and they assumed he was there. And he was also on the plane. So it's like he couldn't escape it somehow. It just was destined to happen. Even because he wasn't there, he still didn't escape being there. Very interesting situation. So it shows how karma comes to us in interesting ways, and whatever it is, we're responsible for it. So this requires a certain detachment that sometimes we don't have, but whatever we see someone do to us, we need to put that person aside and only see ourselves doing it to us through that person. We are doing this to ourselves through that person. The person is just a channel for it. When we look at it that way, then we're looking at it and accepting responsibility. We don't want to blame the person if they do something nasty to us. We don't want to praise them if they do something kind to us. We want to see ourselves acting through them, which is the correct way to see it. We accept responsibility. Nothing can happen to me that's not in my karma. So the real test is when you get unfairly accused. Sometimes this happens in life. We get unfairly accused by someone. Well, how can that person accuse me of this? We're upset with them. They're not being fair toward us. But somehow, it's our karma. We're creating this experience. Something we've done in the past. This is a reaction to that action and is coming to us through this person. So if we can see it in that way, then we're looking at it correctly and we're accepting responsibility. Gurudeva's quote on this is, as long as we externalize the source of our successes and failures, we perpetuate the cycles of karma, good or bad. There is no one out there making it all happen. Our actions, thoughts, and attitudes make it all happen. We must accept and bear our karma cheerfully. Om Namah Shivaya.